From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
We must go forward based on truth. We cannot both embrace the big lie and embrace the Constitution.
That's Congresswoman Liz Cheney, a Republican of Wyoming, speaking to reporters right after House Republicans voted to remove her from her House leadership position earlier today. The vote is in response to Cheney's criticism of former President Donald Trump and his false claims that the election was stolen. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis is in Washington. And Sue, the outcome of this vote is not surprising. Liz Cheney has been steadfast in her rebuke of Trump's election lies. But remind us how we got here and walk us through how today's vote unfolded.
Well, it really goes back to the assault on the Capitol on January 6th. Cheney, unlike most Republicans, directly blamed Donald Trump for the events of that day. She voted to impeach him, and she was, you know, House Republicans tried back in February to remove her over that vote, but she beat it back by a 2-to-1 margin on a secret ballot. But it was since then she just hasn't relented in her criticism of Trump. And every time that he's popped up to again try to baselessly claim that the election was somehow fraudulent or that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president of the country, Liz Cheney has been a very prominent voice pushing back against this and saying it's wrong, it's a lie, and it's bad for democracy. She's also gone as so far as to say that she believes Trump's ongoing efforts could provoke more violence in the country. And that just put her really out of step with most House Republicans. Some just want her to stop talking about Donald Trump, while frankly, the most House Republicans remain quite loyal to the former president and really want to be closely aligned with him going into the 2022 elections. And her job was one based around messaging and party unity, and she is frankly out of step with where most House Republicans are, and today they decided it was time for her to go.
I want to clarify for you, was today's vote anonymous?
It was, but all leadership elections are done by secret ballot. This today, it was done by voice vote, so we don't actually have a count for who was for or who was against. Frankly, that might be in better in Liz Cheney's efforts because she says she'd like to be a leader against Donald Trump going forward. And if a vote had shown her to have very minimal support within the party, I think it might have further made that even harder for her to do. So, but it is not unusual for this to happen behind closed doors.
I see. What reactions are you hearing from this?
Largely what you would expect. The irony here is some of the biggest praise coming out for Liz Cheney comes from Democrats who are not usually accustomed to praising Republicans like Liz Cheney. Former President Trump put out a statement. He's been obviously in a very personal tit for tat with her, saying that he was glad she was gone, that she's bitter. He intends to work to defeat her next year. But she certainly does have support. Senate Republicans, people like Mitt Romney, Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa this week have said positive things about her, that they want her to remain inside the party. And she has some allies in the House. Republicans like Adam Kinzinger came out and said that he thought it was the wrong decision, but that they have to move forward.
Okay, so let's talk about moving forward. GOP leaders are rallying behind Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York for Cheney's position. But then there are some Republicans, like Republican Congressman Chip Roy, calling Stefanik out in a memo arguing that she's not conservative enough. He said he'd actually rather see someone else fill this position or leave the post empty. What does this mean when he says she's not conservative enough? And what do you think is going to happen?
Well, they opted not to have a leadership election today, but Stefanik is a more moderate Republican than Liz Cheney. She voted against things like the 2017 Trump tax cuts. In the past, she's voted for things like gay rights legislation. So she's not exactly in step with the majority of the conference, but she is a Trump loyalist. And Trump has endorsed her for this position. She has the support of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. And frankly, no one else is running against her. So unless someone steps up and tries to create more of a leadership race here, she does seem on track to get this position. I think it just might take a little bit of cajoling among the conference to feel good about the decision.
Cheney's future. She told reporters today that she doesn't feel betrayed by today's vote. She seems to have accepted it. What's next for her?
Well, the biggest challenge for Cheney in the short term is, can she win re-election? She's already been censured by the Wyoming State Republican Party. She's got a growing list of primary challengers. Donald Trump and sort of broader MAGA universe is pretty committed to trying to defeat her next November. It's a pretty stark change of fortunes for someone who not so long ago was seen as a potential presidential contender one day. She turned down a Senate run to stay in the House in a move seen as maybe trying to chart a path to the speakership. It's hard to squint and see how that could happen now, but she intends to run for re-election. And, you know, people have many acts in political lives these days, so we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Sue Davis is NPR's congressional correspondent. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
The United Nations Middle East envoy warned today that the fighting between Israel and Palestinian militants is escalating toward a full-scale war. Dozens have died this week in the violence, most of them Palestinian, as Israeli airstrikes leveled Palestinian apartment buildings and Palestinian militant groups fired rockets at Israeli cities. Unrest began last week in response to pending evictions of Palestinian families in East Jerusalem and an Israeli raid on Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. For more, we're joined now on Skype by Hanan Ashrawi, a Palestinian leader formerly with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
And as you well know, of course, this conflict goes back many decades. But from your point of view, what is at the heart of this latest round of violence? And is it different than what we've seen in recent conflicts in the region?
Yes, I'm glad you're asking about the context. This government in Israel has decided to escalate to help the prospects of forming a more extreme racist government in Israel by Netanyahu. And he provoked, and the Israeli government provoked the Palestinians, we said, beyond endurance. Killing, so far, they have killed over 53 Palestinians in Gaza, including 15 children and 3 women. Well, it's a real disaster area.
What would stop it? What does your side want? What are you asking for?
I'm asking to deal with the causes rather than with the symptoms or the after effects. The cause is the ongoing, brutal, cruel, illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, the killing of Palestinians with impunity, kicking them out of their homes. This is a very serious situation. Until you hold Israel to account for all these actions, this will continue. It's the time for international law to prevail, for the U.S., for Europe. This is where you intervene. You provide the Palestinians with protection as per the Fourth Geneva Convention and Israel with accountability.
Well, on the issue of the evictions and the settlements, I mean, there are some Jews who say that they were the ones who were in those areas first, that they have the right to the land. But of course, that's at the heart of this dispute, and we're not going to settle it here. On the other hand,
we have to address this issue because you cannot pull out a Bible and pull out a chapter from the Bible and say, this is my land deed and this is what gives me the right. This was Palestine. This has been Palestine. If you read history, it existed, references to it in the 4th century BC with Herodotus talking about Palestine. No, we've been here for thousands of years. We have an ongoing identity and history and culture, and we will not be erased. That's the issue. We refuse to buckle under. We refuse to surrender.
In fact, Hamas has not backed down at all. The militant group in the Gaza Strip has fired more than 100 rockets at Israeli cities last night. Several Israelis have also died in this conflict. What role and responsibility do you think Hamas has played escalating this conflict?
Yeah, when you tell the bully, when you tell the person who's committing a crime, you have to stop committing this crime, otherwise there will be repercussions, and that person does not stop, then he or she has to be ready for the consequences. Now, Hamas, of course, does not have sophisticated weapons. No, Hamas has these makeshift homemade, what is called rockets, missile projectiles. And yes, we don't want to see any civilians killed. But when you look at the disproportionate power, when you see scores of Palestinians killed, this is not just a question of Hamas using violence. This is a question of a deliberate targeting of a population that has no means of defense, that has no place to run.
But do you support Hamas? This is a group that is militant, that is Islamist, that many countries view as a terrorist organization. Do you think that they're leading Palestinians in the right direction here?
I, of course, have ideological disagreements. Religion should be left out of politics. And this certainly applies more to Israel than to Hamas, frankly speaking. But at the same time, I believe in the right to express their opinions. The question is the Palestinian people. This is a popular uprising. So the question is not Hamas. The question is, how do you deal with the cause? How do you deal with this occupation?
Well, the Biden administration has called for both sides here to calm down, which in effect, of course, has satisfied neither Israel nor the Palestinians. What kind of response are you looking for from the White House?
One thing, for the first time, the Biden administration said that Palestinians and Israelis are equally entitled, you know, to the right. This is unusual since Trump and previous administrations have always maintained Israel above the law and having superior rights, while Palestinians have no rights whatsoever. So let's translate that into a policy, into action. Let's tell Israel it has to abide by the law, and let's tell the Palestinians they do have the protection of the law. And this is how you can bring peace, security, stability, not just to Palestine, Israel, but to the whole region.
Hanan Ashrawi, formerly of the Palestine Liberation Organization, speaking with us from Ramallah. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
A new documentary looks at the difficult relationship between the U.S. and Cuba through the eyes of two brothers who are also incredibly talented musicians. They made the music you're listening to now. Ilmar Gavilan is a violinist who grew up in Cuba, but left at the age of 14 to study in the Soviet Union. He never returned. Instead, he built an international career as a teacher and a performer who eventually settled in the United States. Aldo Lopez Gavilan is a pianist and a composer who stayed and made a name for himself in Cuba. For decades, the two musicians were never able to perform or to record together, but in the new film, Los Hermanos, we see politics shifting over time, and Aldo and Ilmar are able to achieve a dream they've been pursuing their entire lives. The film opens in theaters this Friday. Brothers is also the name of Ilmar and Aldo's first recorded album together. Ilmar Gavilan and Aldo Lopez Gavilan join me now. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us, Peter. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Yes, it's a great pleasure.
And Ilmar, so let's start with you, okay? You left Cuba at the age of 14 to study violin in the Soviet Union. Talk about why you decided to leave.
Well, at the time, my violin teacher in Cuba explained to my parents that if I wanted to continue developing, I had to leave because in my native country, there was no opportunity for further developing. In other words, they thought that I got as good as I could there. It's not like, you know, a little kid chooses to do it. It was just a commitment to my craft and, you know, to my family and myself.
Well, speaking of little kid, Aldo, this was your big brother, right?
Right, yes.
What was it like to see him leave, and did you think he'd ever come back?
Oh, it was very terrible. It was very sad for me. I was only 8, and I was used to play around with him and, you know, do what kids do at that age. And, yeah, it was a big change for all of us.
Did you miss each other?
It was beyond missing. It was just like, you know, a part of you is somewhere else. You know, thank goodness for these tapes he used to send me. Our letters were via tapes, and I could hear the surrounding noises, his music, his little, you know, infant voice. He had a very thin voice still at the time. I could hear my grandpa's steps in the background, the ocean. All of these sounds gave me the taste of home.
So two brothers, both musicians, separated by many, many miles, and of course, many complicated political conflicts. I do want to hear one of your compositions, Aldo. This is off of your album, Brothers, with Ilmar. The track is called Epilogo.
Thank you.
getting to this point must have been a dream come true, because you had never been able to record music together because you were separated by both distance and by politics. Why was it important for you to make this album?
Oh, this was a long time dream come true, really, because Ilmar was always a fan of my music, of course, and I was a fan of his playing. Making an album together as brothers and performers was something that it was really needed for us, professionally and emotionally.
The process was so joyful because a lot of things that happen in the studio have to do with rehearsing, and in this kind of music, the communication of the soul and the musical understanding plays a huge role. So because we have basically a lifetime of understanding each other's music, we could anticipate somebody's phrasing or this little delay for a cadence or this color, rather than spend hours and hours trying to perfect it. We just feel it at the same time.
Although I can't imagine what that would be like to be in person with your brother as two musicians and two brothers playing together and sort of connecting in person like that when you had been separated for so long. What was it like for you?
It's beyond words. The communication in all sense as brothers were beyond normal communication between musicians that have played all their lives together. I feel very comfortable playing my music with Ilmar because he knows the music sometimes even better than me. Sometimes he can explain with words the messages that my music sometimes have.
Well, it was under the Obama administration when tensions started to cool off, of course, between the two countries, and that's when you got the chance to tour together in the United States. Let's listen to you, Aldo, playing your piece Quick Tune with Ilmar and his ensemble, the Harlem Quartet, here in the U.S. Having been a musician in both places now, I just wonder what your impressions of the two countries are.
This is Ilmar here in Cuba. Aldo always mentions that the pianos are out of tune, not every hall has a good piano. But guess what? Every time there is some sort of concert, you will see the audience from diverse background, not just like the people that are more cultured, but diverse background are supposed to hear it in the States. It's a very particular targeted audience that tends to come out to classical concerts. That's something that we like to be, ambassadors for, that music, good music is good music. And because the nature of Aldo's writing is particularly accessible, we feel very privileged to attract different type of audiences to regular venues.
So you've come so far in the last several years, but there's been such whiplash, too. I mentioned President Obama earlier. Here he is in 2016 announcing this new era in diplomatic relations between the two countries. Let's listen.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
And then just a little over a year later, President Trump reversed course in Miami. Here he is.
We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
What has this whiplash been like? And where exactly do things stand now for you personally? Aldo, why don't you take that?
Well, as you can imagine, things got really bad. In my personal life, it was terrible to have to travel to a third country. to get the American visa to come here and perform with my brother. But the whole country and people in general in Cuba have suffered tremendously. And to be honest, now in this moment is one of the biggest crises in so many, many years because of the pandemic.
Right.
So it's not has been easy at all.
So Ilmar, here you are both at the intersection of music and politics. What do you think the power of your music is to help bridge the kind of problems that we've experienced between these two countries over the years?
You hit it in right there. I think music itself is a phenomenon that unites peoples and makes you feel the common humanity in all of us. And music, in our case, is beyond politics, but also is an instrument to realize everything that can be achieved if we were left to be just normal human beings that want to express their music and their love beyond artificial borders when it comes to geopolitical borders.
And this is why we have art in our lives, right? Ilmar Gavilan and Aldo Lopez Gavilan are two brothers and the focus of the documentary Los Hermanos. Thank you to you both.
Thanks for having us, Peter. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Los Hermanos opens in theaters on Friday. We have more information about the film and the album that they released together. It's called Brothers. It's at hereandnow.org.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So what happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war?
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? Visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
Car manufacturers are having a hard time keeping up with demand because of a global shortage of microchips, and that's making things tough on car rental companies. Some sold off nearly half of their fleets last year when travel crashed because of the pandemic. Now, as summer travel picks up, we might see long lines and higher prices or no rental cars at all. In a story that originally aired on All Things Considered, Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
Glacier Raft Company, this is Rachel.
Customers are eagerly calling in to book their rafting trips near Glacier National Park this summer. They go over the normal things you would expect.
And would you be interested in our scenic or our whitewater rafting trip? Whitewater? Okay, perfect.
But the staff are also asking customers flying in if they have a rental car. Owner of the local Hertz franchise, Dale Duff, says much of his and other rental car companies' inventory this summer is already booked.
We're faced with a definite shortage of cars, and the airline industry's had enough faith in us to bring more seats in here. So we have a definite problem.
There will be 80,000 more airline seats available coming here compared to 2019, but 2,000 fewer cars available to rent. The Glacier area is not alone.
I think it's widespread, but I think it's more prevalent in the vacation resort markets.
Chris Waronka, a leisure analyst at Deutsche Bank, says Florida had a spring break car crunch and expects more places to have one this summer, although the supply and demand mismatch isn't as extreme in many big cities. Rentals near Yellowstone National Park are currently going for $200 a day or more for a car. Exactly how widespread the shortage will be this summer, Waronka says, will be more clear when car rental companies release their first quarter numbers in early May.
I suspect we're going to be dealing with these rental car shortages and abnormally high prices certainly through the summer.
Back at the raft company, owner Cassie Baldelli says business owners near Glacier National Park are concerned tourists may not fly here if they can't get a rental car. Surrounding towns are small, so there's not much public transportation, and service from ride-hailing options like Uber or Lyft can be spotty.
It's been fairly unreliable in the past, but knowing that there is a car rental shortage and stuff, we're hopeful that maybe that will encourage more drivers to partake in that.
Tourist businesses here are encouraging locals to rent their personal cars on apps like Turo, and there's even been talk of using a local ski bus to shuffle tourists around who land here without a car. Racine Freedy with Glacier Country Tourism Marketing says there's also hope that one pandemic trend continues. Lots more people driving their own cars here for getaways, even from very far away.
We generally anticipate kind of a drive market of about 600 miles. Our drive market last year was all the way to Florida. That could kind of roll over into the 2021 season.
So as excited as tourist destinations are that air travel is back, they're also letting people know that they'll be very happy if people decide to put some miles on those commuter vehicles that have probably been spending a lot of time in their garages lately too. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton, Columbia Falls, Montana.
Doctors at Johns Hopkins have found that some of those most at risk for COVID-19 may not be getting protection from the vaccines. A new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found 46% of transplant patients produce no antibodies after either dose. Let's bring in Dr. Dori Segev, a transplant surgeon at Johns Hopkins who worked on the study. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. Let's take a closer look at these findings. Researchers studied almost 700 transplant recipients getting the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. Can you explain how their bodies responded to them?
Transplant patients, after one dose, only 17% demonstrated any antibody response at all. And in general, these antibody responses were lower than those with people with normal immune systems. After two doses, we were hoping that things would get better, and they did indeed get better. About half of transplant patients demonstrate some antibody. The other half still don't demonstrate any antibody after two doses of the mRNA vaccines.
What are some of the reasons why?
Well, transplant patients take immunosuppression medications. These are medications that purposefully block your immune system so that you don't get a rejection of the organ that you had transplanted. So we're playing this balancing game between making sure that, you know, you don't reject your organ and also having enough of an immune system to have a response to a vaccine. And what we're seeing, there are transplant patients who got both doses of the vaccine and then reduced their protective behaviors and ended up getting what we call breakthrough COVID infections at a much higher rate, it seems, than people with normal immune systems. So it's really important that transplant patients continue to be careful just as they would be careful were they unvaccinated.
Could these anti-rejection drugs be safely tailored to give transplant patients a better chance of developing antibodies?
Well, one potential step forward is to try to give people a third dose of the vaccine. You can imagine that even if two doses didn't get you to where you want to be in terms of protective immunity, you've started your immunologic journey. And whatever it is that we need to do down the road, whether it's giving a third dose, whether it's giving a different platform, you've already started that immunologic journey. And you're building protection as you're receiving these doses. Another thing that people have been talking about is, well, if they're on immunosuppression drugs, maybe you can stop or reduce something in the immunosuppression regimen to allow the vaccine to work better. Unfortunately, this is quite risky. If you're reducing immunosuppression so that the vaccine will work better, you're putting yourself at risk for two reasons. One is you're reducing the immunosuppression that you normally take that under normal circumstances keep you from getting a rejection. The second is the vaccine activates the immune system on purpose. So now you're reducing immunosuppression at a time where you're also activating the immune system, which may have the side effect of causing a rejection in your organ. Another thing that we're doing is looking at the B cell and T cell immunity. It is certainly possible that even without a good antibody response, people would have immune protection because of a good T cell response.
I'm just curious, if the COVID vaccines have limited results in transplant patients, what about other vaccines like the flu shot? Do they work for transplant patients and other people with compromised immune systems?
In general, vaccines don't work as well for immunosuppressed patients. We've seen this with flu vaccine and with other vaccines. Ultimately, what typically happens is for a given disease, the fact that an overwhelming majority of the population gets those vaccines, like the flu vaccine, transplant patients are secondarily protected. And that's obviously the big hope that everybody could have, is that the more people that can get the vaccine with intact immune systems, the more we protect the people with vulnerable immune systems like transplant patients.
Right. This further underscores why it's so important to reach herd immunity.
Correct. While it's frustrating that only half of transplant patients get an antibody response to the vaccine, still half of transplant patients get an antibody response to the vaccine. So it is very, very important for transplant patients to get vaccinated. And then we will learn more in the coming months about what those vaccines do, not just to antibodies, but to the B cell and the T cell immunity.
That's Dr. Dori Segev talking about the research into vaccine efficacy for people with organ transplants. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, just months after a coronavirus surge left hospitals overwhelmed, the LA Times is reporting that Los Angeles County could reach herd immunity by mid to late July. It's another milestone that underscores the region's rapid recovery from the pandemic. And other parts of the country are making progress, too. Many Native American communities have been ahead of the pack getting people vaccinated. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs reports on one in Iowa that's also nearing herd immunity.
Genesis Ramirez grips a digital timer, her legs swinging in a chair in the waiting room of the Meskwaki Tribal Health Center in Tama County, Iowa. The 17-year-old just got her second dose of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, but she didn't do it just to keep herself safe.
My family is very high risk, and I don't want to bring anything back to them where I can't help them.
Ramirez isn't a member of the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi, also known as the Meskwaki Nation, but she is one of the 2,600 people who live or work on the tribe's 8,000-acre settlement west of Cedar Rapids. She's now one of the many members of her community who's fully vaccinated against COVID-19.
I've been waiting and I've been wanting to get a vaccine just so I can know that I did something to help.
According to state data, less than half of adult Iowans have been fully vaccinated. That's far short of what experts say is needed for herd immunity. Meskwaki Nation officials estimate more than 70% of those eligible who live and work on the settlement are fully vaccinated.
I'm actually a little surprised, to be honest.
Rudy Papaki is the health director of the Meskwaki Tribal Health Center.
I didn't expect our numbers to be this high this quick. I thought eventually we'd start, you know, we'd hit a plateau where we're trying to build upon those numbers, but we actually hit a pretty, in my opinion, a pretty substantial number from the very beginning.
As Iowa's only federally recognized tribe, Meskwaki Nation leaders faced a unique choice last fall. They could get the vaccine through the state of Iowa or the federal government's Indian Health Service. Papaki says the tribe chose the feds.
I just thought the connection with Indian Health Service was going to be much stronger. They made some promises right from the beginning that once we get it, we'll get it to your hands as quickly as we can.
Papaki says that's just what happened. Doses started coming in slowly in December. They vaccinated elders and healthcare workers first and quickly moved on. But vaccine hesitancy was prevalent at the start. Even tribal leaders like Dolanda Pushatiniqua initially turned down the vaccine.
I was one of the people who said no, you know, like, I don't trust the government to be able to give us a vaccine.
But Pushatiniqua says the Meskwaki Nation is a close-knit community with many multi-generational homes. She says that's what ultimately persuaded her to change her mind.
Like, I don't want to be that person who, you know, gets my dad sick or, you know, any of my uncles, you know, who might not fare as well if they were to get COVID.
Pusha Taniqua says she believes this has pushed others to get vaccinated as well. But officials say it's taken more than that. Sarah Augsburger is the clinic nurse manager at the tribe's health center. She says the center staff works hard to spread accurate vaccine information and address concerns. And Augsburger says she's careful not to push anyone who's not ready.
And I also tell people, if you're not comfortable, then it's not time. You know, once you get comfortable with it, that's when you should get vaccinated. And I've had four or five people be like, nobody's ever said that to me. You know, I feel like everybody's forcing me, but that it makes sense, and have actually turned around and gotten vaccinated.
Health Center Director Papaki says he posts updates regularly in Meskwaki Facebook groups to address ongoing hesitations. He says he answers questions directly and tailors the experience of getting vaccinated to the community.
We created a post on social media that said, if you've had the vaccine, what were your reactions? So, and it's no longer, I read this on the news or I saw it on the internet. It's your friend, your neighbor, your cousin, your relative.
Papaki says when demand for the vaccine started to decline, Meskwaki leadership launched a program for the settlement's 500 tribal operations employees. It offers them a $100 Visa gift card for each COVID-19 shot they get. That's pushed their group's vaccination rate to nearly 80%. It's a program Papaki says he hopes to extend to all tribal members soon, so he can reach his goal of getting 85% vaccinated. For Here and Now, I'm Natalie Krebs.
In major cities up and down the East Coast, gas stations are running out of fuel. It is a result of the cyber hack on the Colonial Pipeline, which moves fuel from Texas to New Jersey. The pipeline is still shut down, and now half of gas stations in Atlanta have run dry. A quarter in North Carolina are out of fuel. Our digital producer, Serena McMahon, is on a road trip in Asheville, North Carolina. And she was out late last night trying to find an open pump. She spoke with a driver from California named Mackie Velage, who wasn't sure how to make it back to Chapel Hill, over 200 miles away.
And I didn't think anything of it because I didn't hear about it in California. But we heard on the news that there was no gas today. And we went to 10 different stations and we still haven't been able to find anything until today.
Oh boy, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Seth, welcome.
Good to be here, Peter.
So as we just heard, cities starting to groan under the weight of this pipeline hack. What are you seeing out there?
Well, it's in the southeast, as you mentioned, that things are toughest. Other parts of the country, you know, I'm sitting here in Pennsylvania, you have less impact. You have stations that do typically rely on that pipeline, but also with other sources. We heard from that person there in Asheville coming from California, didn't even know about it. Other places where there's impact, but it's more behind the scenes. Really the southeast where you hear those stories about lots of gas stations that simply don't have gas.
Is this panic buying sort of like the toilet paper shortages we saw early in the pandemic?
That is a lot of what this is. You know, believe it or not, even if you didn't have any supply issue, if all of a sudden all of us with cars ran out to fill up those cars at once on any day, there would be shortages just because that's the way the system works. You know, we just don't do that. It doesn't sound like a lot having to put 5 or 10 gallons in a car, but if everybody did it all at once, it would be a problem on any day. Just like if everybody suddenly, yeah, buys lots of toilet paper, it would be a problem on any day. And so that's what you get, is the vicious cycle of this very real supply issue. You know, people aren't wrong that there's a problem, but then when they run out and buy more gas than they usually would, it really exacerbates it, especially in those places that are highly dependent on this pipeline.
Right. So what are the knock-on effects of this run on gas stations? What does it mean for, well, we heard what it meant for one tourist, but there's also truckers out there, city bus systems, a lot of commerce relying on this fuel.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have some public transportation systems in the southeast suspending certain bus routes, kind of having to pick and choose, you know, what's the very most essential service. We've heard that word so many times over this past year in other contexts, right? What's truly essential, and having to make tough choices about basically who's not going to be able to get to work because their bus route is suspended. You mentioned truckers and logistical challenges, you know, a lot of logistics these days, Peter, based on what's called just-in-time inventory, right? Doing things, not building up a big inventory of anything. It's kind of buying what you need when you need it. And now obviously having to plan in a very different way that some of these companies haven't been used to doing in a long time.
Well, that pipeline was sort of important for jet fuel as well, wasn't it? What about the airline industry?
Indeed. That's one industry where, you know, you might think, Peter, that, of course, airlines would just always keep the planes as full as possible. But that's not how it works. You know, typically they put as much fuel on board as they need for the next flight, plus, of course, some extra for safety. You know, the idea is you don't want to put too much fuel onto a plane because then you weigh down the plane and it's actually inefficient to carry more fuel than you need. Now, very different, right? Now, if you're flying in a plane from somewhere where there is fuel, you're going to fill it up as much as possible. And even then, you might have to make adjustments like American Airlines is doing out of Charlotte, stopping some of its flights, long-haul flights to Honolulu and London in places like Dallas, Fort Worth, and Boston on their way to pick up more fuel because there just isn't enough fuel to fill up the plane to get to those destinations.
Wow. Well, Colonial Pipeline officials say they hope that they're going to get most of that pipeline back up by the end of the week. Gas prices in Georgia already up 11 cents. Governors are declaring states of emergencies and suspending gas taxes temporarily. How much worse do you think things are going to get before they get better?
Probably not a whole lot worse because, again, so much of the impact is just the panic buying that has already happened, right? So just as once people realized that there was going to be toilet paper at some point, some of the problem just kind of went away by itself. If indeed things are getting better in terms of the very real supply issues by this weekend, I don't think this is something we're going to be thinking about long into the future, most of us. Now, the folks have to keep these systems secure. That's a different story. All kinds of lessons here to be learned, but we
right.
might be at least.
What are those lessons?
A few days away. Just about the interoperability of these systems, right? I mean, there was an airline systems outage last month, Peter, that impacted dozens of airlines around the world. They couldn't sell airline tickets for several days. Some smaller airlines around the world. So that's how reliant these systems are on other systems. So it's going to matter to certain folks for a very long time to make sure that the rest of us don't have to worry about it very much in the future.
All right. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Thanks very much. I hope you don't need to get gas in the Southeast anytime soon.
Exactly. Luck. Thank you, Peter.
All right. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.